Chael said, and that there is peace now between the six duchies and the Out Islands? His silence was longer this time. Some of that I knew. I knew your prince would wed the Narcheska of the Out Islands. The rest, they give me no news here. I know little beyond what I dream. Capra says that keeps my dreams pure, uninfluenced by the outside world. And I do dream, and I record those dreams. I am like the bird that sings in its cage, with no knowledge of season or mates or offspring. The dreams I write they take from me, for good or evil, I cannot say. To dream and record the dreams is my path. It is what I must do.
And you dreamed about me. I felt a little shiver of importance.
For many years. At first, you were unlikely. Then, I would guess it was nearly 10 years ago. It is hard for me to know. Time passes so differently when one is confined.
About the time I was born, I guessed.
Truly? You are so young to be working such great changes, so small.
I wish I could just have stayed at home. I did not want this. My throat closed, and I felt a stirring of anger. You caution me about all the people whose lives I will affect. But Dwalia and the servants cared nothing for that. They killed so many of my people. So many children will go on alone. So many children will never be born. None of that stayed her hand. His strong black fingers closed around my scarred white ones. His grip was warm, but I felt how thin and fine the bones in my hands were. He could have crushed my hand. Instead, he held it warmly and said,
But you are not her. You are the true white prophet for this time. You must look for what leads to the greatest good for all. You cannot be heartless or selfish, as your catalyst was.
I did not think of what I would do. I was adept at that now. Vindalaya's magic might be weakened, but he still had some. And if the servants had more serpent spit and gave it to him, I felt a sudden surge of urgency. I must not be stopped. I think Prilkop felt my resolve in how I drew my hand away from his clasp.
When people do not know the past, they make the same mistakes their forebears made,
he warned me. I drew a great breath and wondered if that was true. Then I lay back on my bed and stared at the stone lacework of the wall. I thought of all he had said. If I just stay here in my cell, they will kill me, you say.
So I have dreamed. A harsh breath. A candle goes out.
I let the tiny edge of my plan creep into my mind. How much had his dreams told him of me? Did he know my intentions? You think I should stay in my cell? He heaved a great sigh.
I only say to you that it is a possibility you may not have considered. Perhaps you should try to see where that decision might lead.
In a very quiet voice, he added,
For us, it is not always about our own survival. It is about the path we believe is best for the world.
Vindalaya told me you could feel when he was on the true path. Well, I feel mine now. It feels right, Prilkop.
So many things do when they are things we want to do.
What did you dream me doing? There was a smile in his voice.
I dreamed many different paths for you, some more likely than others.
He whispered the words to me again, that peculiarly familiar rhyme.
A piebald bird, a silver ship. Oh, what are you awaking? One shall be two, and two be one, before the future's breaking.
It still made no sense to me. I told you before, I have no piebald bird, nor a ship. Prilkop, just tell me, do I break the future?
Oh, child, We all do. That is both the danger and the hope of life, that each of us changes the world every day.
His smile was sad.
Some of us more than others.
What's that? There had been a sound, or rather a flurry of sounds. A thud, a muffled yelp, a louder thud. I held my breath, listening. Prilkop drew back his hand, and I imagined that he fled back to his desk and paper. Down the corridor, a door opened. I slipped back to sit on the edge of my mattress. The footsteps that came now were soft. I waited. Then a whisper, softer than the wind.
Prilkop, you live. You live.
Who is there?
Prilkop asked, his voice deep with suspicion.
A friend.
A laugh, soft as the first patter of rain.
One who goes cloaked in a gift from you. I have the guard's keys. I will have you out of there.
A soft scraping of metal on metal.
Beloved, you are here?
Prilkop's voice lilted with incredulous joy.
Yes, and finding you fills me with delight. But there is another I seek, a child, a little girl named Bee.
Beloved, my father's friend, the beggar from the market.
The fool?
I darted to the bars of my cell, seized them, and looked out. No one was there. I could see nothing, but I heard the soft jingle of keys. Inside me, Wolffather hackled to alertness. We stared. Prilkop spoke in a whisper, his voice shaking with excitement.
Wrong keys, old friend. They'll open the other cells, but not this one, or Bee's. But she is here, and she has...
Both doors suddenly clashed open at each end of the corridor. I heard Capra's voice raised in a shout.
Advance! Shoulder to shoulder! Swing your baton solidly! Go! Do not stop until you stand chest to chest with your fellows! The intruder is here!
But...
someone objected. And...
Go!
She shrieked.
Go now at a run. Strike high, strike low. I know he is there. Trust your batons, not your eyes. Go!
Someone I could not see made a sound of panic. I heard a scuff. Then, from nowhere, I saw the flash of a disembodied leg. Someone I could not see clearly strove to climb the smooth bars of the cell opposite Prilkop's. He was a rippling shape of nothing, as when one looks through the rising heat of a fire. He went up swiftly, and I had a glimpse of his bare feet curling as if to grip the bars. An edge of a butterfly cloak flared and rolled for an instant.
There!
A man's voice shouted harshly, and the guards came at a run down the corridors. I stepped back, for I heard the harsh clang of short staves hitting the bars of the cells as they came. I heard exclamations from the other prisoners, and then, as the guards reached my cell, the terrible thud of a stick on flesh, and a sharp grunt of pain. Wolffather snarled frenziedly. My leaping heart felt as if the wolf inside me were trying to batter his way out.
He's here! He's down!
A guard shouted. For a moment I saw a man on the floor outside my cell. Then he coiled his body and flipped up onto his feet. With the heel of his hand, he hit one guard on the jaw, clanging the man's head against the cell bars. Beloved spun, cloak swirling, and I saw only parts of him. An armless hand seized the other guard's staff and jammed it sharply up under the man's jaw, and he fell back with a gurgling cry. If he'd had only two opponents, I think he would have escaped. But the guard behind him swung his short staff savagely. It connected, and Beloved fell. He rolled to his belly, to his knees, the cloak camouflaging him again. But they knew where he was. Swift blows rained down on someone I could not see as Capra shouted,
"Enough! Enough! Do not kill him! I have questions for him! Many questions!"
I had retreated to the back wall of my cage. I could not get my breath. Capra came pushing through the guards, who now stood like confused and excited hounds whipped back from a kill. She looked at the floor, nudged something with her foot. Then she raised her gaze to sweep from me to Prilcop's cell.
Oh!
She exclaimed merrily.
What is this I see on the floor? A butterfly's wing? There's a dream I've read and even dreamed myself. Come, Prilcop, see your dreams fulfilled.
She called to him, but I was the one who flew across my cell to stare down in horror as she stooped and lifted the edge of what looked like a butterfly's wing. As she peeled it back, it was my dream fulfilled. A pale man lay there. He was barefoot and dressed all in black beneath the cloak. A ring of keys had fallen from his hand. Blood was running from a split on his brow and from his nose. His eyes were half closed. He was motionless. Prilcop groaned deeply in despair. I had no breath to make any sound. She stooped beside him and then looked up toward Prilcop's cell. Her old woman's voice had a musical lilt as she said,
I still dream best and truest of all. Here he is, the butterfly man, the trapper trapped. Oh, come, do not hide how impressed you are.
She shook her head coquettishly and added with false sadness,
Though I am grieved that you still have not learned who to be friends with. This was a bad decision, Prilcop, and I fear you must be taught yet again that it is painful to defy me.
A man has two hands. One of the butterfly man's hands was outflung on the floor, the keys just fallen at his fingertips. It was the other hand, the one still covered by the cloak, that darted into sight. I thought he had struck her with his clenched fist until he pulled back the bloodied knife and drove it again into her belly. Capra didn't scream. She made a short sound of disbelief, and then her guards moved in, kicking and clubbing until Beloved lay still and bloodied on the floor outside my cage. I covered my ears, but that did not stop Wolffather's long howl from deafening me to all else. The guards had dragged Capra back. She sat on the floor, both hands clutching her belly. Her blue robe was dark with blood, and scarlet trickled out between her fingers.
Idiots!
She tried to shout, but had no breath for it.
Carry me to the healers, now! And take Beloved and Prilcop to the lower dungeons and throw them in! Put Beloved in Dwalia's old cell! I will see to him myself! Ah!
The last was a cry of pain as two of her guards attempted to obey her.
We will need the keys for the lock of four, one of the guards pointed out.
Use those on the floor.
One of the guards stooped and picked them up.
Wrong keys, he said.
Capra said nothing. I think she had fainted. One of her guards spoke.
Jessim, go ask Felody what we should do. Warham and I will take Capra to the healer. The rest of you, take the intruder to the lowest level. Toss him in and lock him up well. No more mistakes today.
As they lifted Capra, the man added gloomily,
We shall all wear stripes for this.
Neither Prilcop nor I spoke as they moved away. They dragged Beloved with them, his head lolling and bumping on the floor as he went. I heard the door slam, and then someone said,
The jailer's dead! This fellow must have killed her for the keys! Bring the body!
For a time longer, the quiet held, and then, like startled birds, the other prisoners began to whisper-shriek to one another, speculating, demanding answers and weeping aloud.
Prilcop?
I asked questioningly.
Do you know what will happen now? Do you have any dreams of this time?
I do not.
In my softest whisper, I said only for him,
I have keys. We could flee.
There is no place to flee to, little one. They will have closed the doors and the gates.
He laughed bitterly.
If I leave here again, it will be when my body flows out of the waste tank with the waste of the castle. The fishes will eat my flesh, and my bones will turn into sand.
Did you dream that?
I asked in horror.
Some knowledge comes not from dreams, but from life. There is only one exit from Clarys that is not guarded both day and night, and that is the one the dead take. Dwalia and I will share the same resting place in an eel's belly.
He gulped.
I wish my journey there would be a short one, but I know it will not.
He was doing a terrible kind of weeping, afraid weeping. It made me cry, too.
Beep, 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 beep.
Someone was shouting my name in a hoarse and scary voice.
What is that?
Prilkop asked, startled out of his terror.
I don't know.
Shh. Whoever it was, I did not want them to find me. The doors at the end of the corridor slammed open again. The tread of many feet. I was frightened, but I had to know. I moved to where I could almost see down the hall. Guards. Felody with Coltrey staggering along beside him. Coltrey looked terrible, both sick and furious. The keys that Capra had used earlier to lock me in now swung from Felody's fist. They marched to Prilkop's cell. They were too close for me to see them as keys went into the locks and were turned. The door was opened.
Take him,
Felody ordered, and the soldiers I could see surged forward. They emerged, four men gripping one. In the corridor, another man knelt and let fall an armful of chains. Prilkop stood, an ox awaiting slaughter as the shackles were fastened to his ankles. He did not resist as the guard stood and chained his wrists as well. I was a coward.
Not me, oh, not me.
I radiated the thought. I desperately hoped the serpent spit magic had not faded from my system. With what skill I could muster, I pushed it at them. Either it worked, or they had not been told to take me. Wolffather distracted me.
Stop that. A way out is a way in.
Wolffather's growl was intense. I obeyed. Walls up. I moved away from the bars and huddled on my mattress. They would drag Prilkop away. To what end? To pain, Capra had promised him. To death? When I had made my decision last night, had I created this future for him? Was it my fault now? Terrified and selfish, I covered my eyes and I prayed with no god in mind.
Let them not take me. Let it not be me.
Hello, B.
Coltrey was outside my cell, leaning on a guard's arm. I gave a short shriek, and I hated that it made him smile. He had renewed his white paste, but it was badly done. Stripes of his flesh showed through. He smiled at me, a loose-lipped, trembling smile.
Don't think I don't know. I do. You killed them, and I will see that you pay. I will.
Stop it,
Felody told him.
Vindalaya has magicked you. How often must I tell you that? We've caught the killer. When we take Prilkop down, you can see for yourself. It's beloved. The fool came back. He'd have good reason to kill Simph. Dwalia was probably just an afterthought. Come on, we need to see Prilkop secured, and then go to see Capra at the healer's chambers. Jessim said it was a short knife. Let's hope it didn't reach anything vital.
They left. Prilkop walked among them, taking short steps as his chains clattered on the stone floor. Doors slammed again. I had begun to hate that noise. Quiet flowed back in. A lone voice from one of the other cells called out,
Guard! Guard!
No one answered. I sat shaking and weeping. It was too much. Someone had come to find me, to rescue me, and failed. And now Prilkop was gone. I had not realized what a comfort he was until he was snatched away. I felt so cold. I could not stop shaking.
Bee? Bee, bee, bee?
The terrible little voice was back. It sounded like I imagined a pexie would sound, not human.
Bee? Bee, bee, bee?
It was coming closer. It made my name a random repetition. I heard a soft noise, like a shaken cloth and a scratching.
Bee! Bee, bee, bee!
I could not stand it. Leave me alone! I shouted. But instead the voice came closer.
Bee! Bee!
Now I could tell where it was coming from. It was right outside the perforated stone wall that threw shadows of seashells and flowers on my cell floor. Something blocked the light from one hole and made a scrabbling sound, like a rat in a wall. I was thankful the holes were so small and the wall so thick. I did not think it could get at me. But as I stared at the wall in stricken horror, a sharp silver beak poked partly out from it. It moved, jabbing the air.
Bee?
It queried.
Bee, bee, bee?
I was imagining it. It couldn't be real. I didn't want to see it, but I couldn't look away. The beak nudged and poked at air as if struggling to come through and get me. I forced myself to stand and then to move to where I had a better angle to see inside the wall hole. A bird's head. A bright eye. I crouched down to see it better.
Bee?
It changed. This had not happened often, and every time it did, it terrified me. The bird's head radiated a corona of pathways. I found a word for it. A nexus, like the one I had seen in the market with the blind beggar. This could not be good. Go away, I begged in a shaking voice.
Purr,
it said in a whisper.
Tell purr, found bee.
Purr, I asked, hope stabbing me. Perseverance. Hope was a different kind of terror. How could purr be near, so far from Withywoods? Was he truly alive? Had the beggar brought him? The bird shimmered, not before my eyes, but in my mind. Closing my eyes didn't help. I still didn't open them. I asked a question, knowing that the answer could destroy all my hope. Is purr coming to help me, to rescue me?
No, no. Shut. Gate shut. Closed. Closed, closed, closed.
I sat back on my heels. This wasn't real. Birds didn't talk like that. Not in a way that made sense. Was I going mad? The shimmering was making me feel sick. Go away, I begged.
Closed, closed. Amber? Find Amber. Spock asks.
Was saying nonsense phrases now. Go away. A way out is a way in. Tell him that. A way out is a way in. Tell her. Wolffather was leaping in my mind, scrabbling at the walls I held so tight. Tell the bird that. He flung himself against walls I dared not lower. The bird seemed to have wedged itself. It was trying to back out of the hole in the wall without much success. A way out is a way in, I told it, with no sense of why that was important. It stopped struggling. Had it heard me? Was it trying to speak to me? A cat had spoken to me once. Back in Withywoods. But that had been mind to mind, and somehow less surprising. This bird spoke human words with a crow's beak. It was uncanny. Frightening. Bird, did you come with purr? Did he come with the beggar? They have taken the beggar to the dungeon. Was he supposed to rescue me? Talk to me, bird. My questions rattled out of me.
Way in, not easy way out. In was easy, out is hard.
The crow complained.
Stuck.
I drew a deep breath, mastered my dizziness. Is purr nearby? One question at a time.
No, purr can't help. Stuck. No purr here. Stuck.
Solve the bird's problem, and perhaps she would answer. Do you want me to push you out?
No!
I heard more scrabbling sounds. Then, resignedly,
yes.
I reached into the hole.
Careful, careful,
she warned me. I touched her beak. She braced it against my hand. A hard peck. A push. It was like a lightning flash. Dragons. A red dragon would come. I jerked my hand back. A way out is a way in, where the waste goes out from the castle. Tell her. She wasn't stuck anymore. She was backing away from me, taking the shimmering nexus of possibilities with her. A way out is a way in, where the waste goes out from the castle. Tell Per. I heard a wild fluttering of wings. I think she is gone, I said aloud.
Did she hear you?
I don't know, I whispered. The wind blew, and a single downy feather flew into my cell. I caught it. It was a gleaming red. I don't know.
Chapter 32. A Way In.
There is a walled garden. The sun shines on it, but it is plain to see a blight has stricken it. Only a few plants stand straight and tall. The rest are pale and stunted, straggling across the rich soil. The gardener comes. The gardener wears a wide-brimmed hat covered in butterflies. I cannot see his face. He carries a bucket. There are silver shears at his belt, but he kneels in the garden and begins to rip the diseased plants from the earth. He stuffs them into the bucket. The plants in the bucket writhe and moan, but the gardener pays no heed. He does not stop until every sickly plant has been torn up by the roots. He carries the bucket to a bonfire and throws in the shrieking plants.
That's done, he says. The root of the problem is gone.
He turns to me and smiles. I cannot see his eyes or nose, but his teeth are pointed like a dog's, and they drip flames.
From Repin's Dream Journal, Dream 723. We stood and waited in the hot sun. I longed to discard my warm woolen cloak. Instead, I felt the sweat turn into a tiny itching stream down my spine. She's only a bird, I warned them all. It was a wonderful idea, Per, but we cannot hope for too much.
She's smart, Per insisted stoutly.
I'm so thirsty, Spark said.
It was a statement, not a complaint.
I'm hungry,
Per agreed. You're always hungry.
I am,
Per agreed. His gaze never left the sky above the castle. We passed an inn. I conceded to ordinary needs. Let's sit down and think. I led them back to the road. Most of the crowd had dispersed. Only a few stragglers still trudged along. The guards had plainly wished to clear the area around the gate to the causeway. It was not in our plans to challenge anyone, and so we followed after the disgruntled folk, making their way back to the harbour. I had known a moment of hope when Motley had taken flight. Now my renewed despair and agonizing uncertainty were far heavier than anything else I carried. We came to an inn. I turned aside to it. As we came toward the inn door, Per asked,
If we go inside, how will Motley find us?
Personally, I believed that she had flown back to the ship. We'll sit outside. I gestured at some tables under a shade tree beside the inn. I sat down at a table with Per, while Spark and Lant went inside. Per looked at me.
I feel sick, he said. Hollow.
He lifted his eyes to stare hopefully at the sky.
We're doing what we can. Useless words.
At the other tables, folk were drinking and talking loudly. Lant and Spark came back with mugs of ale and a loaf of dark bread. We ate and drank silently, as the gossip from the other tables spilled over and washed against us. We heard rumors with no foundation. Simph had committed suicide. Felody had killed Simph. Simph had fallen down the stairs and broken her neck. Someone had poisoned her. For a woman who was spoken of so well, it seemed odd that few thought she might have simply died. I listened carefully, but no one spoke of a little girl held captive. There was gossip of Dwalia's return with her repulsive henchman, Vindalaya. She was universally disliked, it seemed, and two people spoke with satisfaction of the lashing she had received for returning alone, without the lurics or fine horses that had gone with her. Neither of them had witnessed it. One had heard a servant tell of Dwalia being dragged bloody down the halls and thence to
the deepest dungeon.
They mentioned no child. I had to wonder silently if B had been consigned to that dark place with her. Returning alone seemed the worst words I had ever heard.
"Do we go back to the ship?"
Spark asked. I had no will to answer. I didn't know. I didn't know anything. Grief and uncertainty exhausted me as much as if I'd waged a bloody battle. I'd lost everything. I tried to think where it had all gone so wrong, and the answer was that it had begun with every decision I'd ever made from the time I first said yes to Shade. And then Purr said, "Here she comes." I stared, a small pair of black wings opening and closing, opening and closing. It could be any bird, really. It came closer. I drained my mug and set it down. "Let's go to meet her," I proposed. We left the inn and crossed the road. There was a short stretch of steep hill, with the sort of grasses and brush that can withstand wind, salt, and the occasional high tide or storm dousing. We didn't hesitate, but climbed down it and then found a way down a rocky outcrop and onto a beach that was as much stone as sand. The tide was still coming in, but there was enough beach for us to stand on and wait. Whatever news our bird did or didn't bring to us, I wanted no eavesdroppers. Purr stood perfectly still, holding his arm up as if he awaited a majestic hawk. Motley did not come with the slow, majestic beats of a raptor, but rocked back and forth as she landed, catching her balance. Purr let her settle before asking, "Did you find her?"
"Bee, bee, bee, bee,"
she announced, bobbing her head up and down.
"Yes, Bee, did you find her?"
"Through the hall. Stark. Bee, 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 bee."
I caught my breath. What to believe? Did I dare hope? Was she only repeating Purr's words? Is she alive? Is she hurt? Does she know we are here?
"And Amber?"
Spark demanded. The bird was suddenly still.
"No."
I sharply motioned everyone to silence. "No what?" I asked the bird.
"No, Amber."
Silence.
"She took the butterfly cloak,"
Spark said, a forlorn hope in her voice. "Did you see Bee? Is she hurt?" I wanted to ask question after question and forced myself to stop, one at a time.
"She talked,"
the bird spoke after a moment's consideration. Then, as if working hard to put words together,
"Oh, little Motley Stark."
I felt a rush of impotent fury, the desire to seize the messenger and crush her in my hands. I needed to know. Wit and skill, I reached out to her. "Please."
"Stupid Fitz."
She spoke the words aloud. Without warning, she leaned away from Purr and darted her beak at my face. Lifting my hand defensively was a reflex. She seized my hand in her silver bill and clung to my sleeve in a battering of wings. We did not connect as cleanly as Night Eyes and I had, but I spied through a tiny crack in her bird mind. A glimpse of a little girl's battered face, blue eyes wide, her cheek bruised. I scarcely recognized her. Bee's anxious voice. "A way out is a way in. Tell Purr where the waste goes out from the castle." And then an incomprehensible view of the castle and the waters surrounding it, as if viewed from the tallest tower or the top of a mast. It moved, and my stomach lurched as Motley showed me what she had seen when she flew over the castle. The roof, the guards pacing there, the cottages in the walled garden, more guards, and then a swooping view of the waters around the castle. Little fishing boats bobbed and cast nets, avoiding the shallows created by the outgoing tide. A plume of greyish-brown water in the sea, as if a rain-swollen river had debouched into it.
"A way out is a way in."
Bee's words echoed again, and then the bird released me, dropping to the sand at our feet.
"Motley!"
Purr cried and stooped to gather her up.
I looked at their anxious, puzzled faces. I didn't smile. It was too slender a hope to support a smile. I spoke the words in a shaking voice. B told Motley to tell you a way out is a way in. I gathered air into my lungs. We have to get ready. We didn't go back to Paragon. I sent Motley back to the ship with a simple message. Please wait. I hope she would remember to deliver it. The inn room we rented was cheap and bare, and all the noise came up through the floor. We lay on the floor, our grand clothing serving as our beds, and fruitlessly tried to sleep. The inn was finally silent when we rose. Leave anything we won't need, I told them. Spark folded all the clothing and gave the stack a fond pat, as if saying farewell. Spark had adapted the firepot belt to ride high on my back. The pack containing the silver and firebrick was secured below it. I gave Lant my buckkeep cloak. Bring this, he nodded. On our way out, I ghosted through the kitchen to steal a pot of grease. I raked ash away from the banked cook fire and mixed it generously. Then I caught up with the others waiting on the shore. We spoke little as we greased our hands and faces with the ashy blend. I had cautioned them that sound carries clear over water. I checked my hidden pockets. I saw Spark making a similar check, and Lant as well. Overhead, there was a full moon, casting more light than I liked over the water. The tide was ebbing. By early morning, it would bear the causeway. But that was not our destination. The retreating tide had left pockets of packed wet sand and squidgy strands and bulbs of kelp underfoot over a rocky beach. Purr fell once, cutting his palms on barnacles exposed on the wet rocks. He made not a sound, but pressed his bloody palms to his belly and held our hurried pace. I had never done anything to deserve such a lad. I looked out at the sea and thought of El, the harsh god of those waters. I had seldom prayed, but that night I offered El both my prayers that he would spare those who accompanied me, and curses for him if he took them from me. We followed the water out as it ebbed. The stink of low tide surrounded us. The land shelved out gently, and I quickly understood why Brashen had chosen to anchor in the deepest part of the harbour. The retreating waves bared rocks and sand, usually immersed in salt water. Small crabs scuttled among the wet stones. I caught the flash of a fingerling stranded in a tide pool. We caught up with the ebbing waves. Now we get wet, I warned the others.
Been wet before,
Purr replied gamely. We waded out, trying not to splash. I heard Lant make a small sound as he took the step that filled his boot with water. And deeper we went, pushing against the water that rose past our knees, our thighs, and then our waists. Wave slapped against us as if to push us away from our goal. The pristine white island of Clare's castle had slimy green roots. I halted us when we were still in darkness, a good distance from the towers and their arches. As the fool had warned, stone basins of oil functioned as lights along the island's shore. We huddled and stared. We must move slowly. We cannot splash. Whisper as little as possible. In the darkness, I could barely see their nods. We need to move as close to the edge of the island as we can, below the level of what the guards can see in the shore lamps. It will be a long slog. This is a gamble. We may or may not find what we seek. We may fail, but we will try this. If you wish to turn back now, I will not think less of you. I have to go on. Such an encouraging speech, Lant muttered. Purr snickered, and Spark said,
I'd follow him into battle.
Purr said, Let's just go. The castle had been built on a peninsula, and those who had cut it free to make it an island
had not cut so deep that some waves did not break white against the barely exposed rocks of the old land. We draped ourselves in the blue cloak to be an amorphous shape on the water. Lant and I were in the lead, clutching the cloak's edge tight so that only our eyes were exposed. Behind us, Spark had her hands on Lant's shoulders, and Purr held my belt. In step we went, in a bizarre dance, slowly, attempting to make no sound. I doubted that the guards in the towers heard our soft whispers.
"There's a low bit here. Watch your footing." "There's something in my boat."
"Shh."
Lant hushed them. Talk ceased. We caterpillared on. The waters continued to recede. Wet white rock peered out beneath wigs of seaweed and barnacle. The water grew shallower as we approached the castle's shoreline. Closer and closer we crept as I navigated by the brief glimpse Motley had given me of the waters around the castle. In thigh-deep water we followed the steep, rocky shore of the island. Chiseled cliffs loomed high above us, and above them the watchtowers looked out and over both land and sea. The steep angle of the sheer cliffs hid us from the guards slowly pacing the perimeter wall above us. The tide was still ebbing.
"Now what?"
Purr breathed.
"Now we follow our noses," I warned him.
We pushed on. The cloak became a dripping bundle in my arms. Every shifting stone underfoot, every harsh breath, sounded loud in my ears. The lights of the shoreside town behind us dimmed as we slowly circled their stronghold. The smell I followed grew stronger, excrement and decomposing garbage. Purr made a small disgusted noise and lifted his hand to cover his nose and mouth. The outflow from the castle flowed in an open trench, gouged into the rock. It gaped, foul and slimy, exposed rhythmically by the retreating waves. Standing salt water sloshed shallowly back and forth in the ditch with every wave.
"How deep is it?"
Purr whispered in trepidation.
"One way to find out,"
I said reluctantly. I sat down on the edge of it, the waves lapping at my waist. My groping feet found no bottom in the thick sludge.
"Give me your hand," I said to Lant, and he knelt to offer it to me.
I took it and eased one foot down into the trough of sloshing filth. I was already soaked to the waist, but that had been clean salt water. Beneath the layer of seawater, my boot sank into muck. I held tight to Lant's hand, stepped down with the other foot, and gasped as I sank. The filth and seawater came halfway up my chest. The stink and the pressure of the cold water squeezed my voice to breathless.
"Tide is going out. I think we can go in this way."
I made a final effort.
"No one has to follow me. This trench will become a tunnel into the side of the island and slope up to the lowest dungeons. It's going to be a foul walk through total darkness. The tunnel will end in the castle's waste tank. The fool said it was in the lower dungeon."
"You warned us back at the inn, before we slept,"
Purr said sourly. "We said we still wanted to come."
"If Amber has been captured, I suspect they'll hold her in the lower dungeon,"
Spark added.
"Yes."
"Then let's go. Dawn is coming," Lant pointed out. "Step down," I invited them, and one after another they did. Purr gave a shuddering gasp, for the filthy water came nearly to his neck. In a line, we trudged forward. We left the open sky and the sea wind behind us as the trench became a tunnel into the chiseled side of the island. No light beckoned at the end. I led them into darkness. Slowly the incline became steeper. The sludge was slippery, and we fought to keep our footing as it sloped slowly upward. It was a stinking, hunched walk. I led with Purr holding onto my belt, then Spark, and finally Lant. I cursed quietly when my groping hand encountered vertical metal bars. but more groping found them badly eaten by the sea. Together, Lant and I bent to until they broke. I squeezed past the obstacle, my belt of pots catching briefly, and the others came behind me. We went as silently as we could through the breathless stench and clinging muck. I heard Lant ask, "Will we be able to come back this way?" "No. When the tide comes in, this will fill with water." He did not ask how we would escape the castle. He knew I didn't know. We walked against a slow, shallow flow of filth as the castle's tank emptied past us to join the retreating tide out into the bay. We slipped in filth. We clung to one another. We cursed quietly. And still they followed me. The darkness was absolute. The slimy wall I touched with my right hand was my only guide. We trudged on. Then, in the distance, a faint half-circle of yellow light appeared. "We should go faster," Per suggested breathlessly. I understood his wish. My back was cramping, and the stench made me even more breathless. "We don't know who might be waiting for us," I reminded him. We kept our steady, quiet pace, and the dim light grew. I reached the arched opening into the vat and motioned into the dusky light for the others to stay back. The tank had a sloping floor, with the day's fresh excrement and offal to wade through. I heard Lant gag. The light that reached us was less than dimness. I found a corroded ladder by touch and pitied those who periodically descended to shovel out the tank. I turned back to Lant and motioned him forward while signaling the others to hold where they were. Lant joined me at the base of the ladder. "I climb. You follow. If there is a guard, the two of us handle him." He gave a tight nod I barely saw. When I was 6 steps up the ladder, I felt him mount it behind me. Rung by slow rung, I climbed, trying not to think of what filth I put my hands on. Up and up and up. The light became marginally stronger. Finally and slowly, I poked my head up above the side of the vat and looked around. Fat pot lamps burned on shelves at the far end of the long room. I saw no one. The thick walls of the vat were of worked stone. I clambered out on top of the wall and discovered steps descending to floor level. Of course, the vat's edges had to be above high tide level. I admired the engineering of it. A high tide would flow in to mingle with the waste in the vat. At the low tide, salt water and waste flowed out again. Lant joined me, and then remained on the top step as I went down the steps, knife drawn. I moved swiftly and as silently as I could through the large room. I saw what the fool had warned me would be there. A table where chains dangled. A large hearth, cold now. The racked tools beside it were not for tending a fire. I hurried past them and heard a rhythmic sound. I halted until I was sure of what it was. Snoring. But was it prisoner or guard? I sought the shadows at the edges of the room and crept forward. A wooden table and a bench outside the cells. A guard slept, face pillowed on his arms, and turned aside from me. Only one guard, so it seemed. Quieter than a cat, I crept forward. With one hand, I gripped hair and lifted the head. With the other, I cut her throat. I clapped a hand over her mouth as her body jerked and pumped blood onto the table. Done. I turned and went back to Lant. I climbed up the steps to speak by his ear. "I think there was only one, and I've done for her." He motioned to the others, and they came quietly out of the tunnel and into the tank. Spark climbed up quickly. Behind her, Per gave a muffled huff and pointed to a body lying on its back in the sloppy filth at the far side of the tank. It was not quite floating. I walked the tank's edge and looked down on it. "It's not the fool or bee," I assured them. It was coated evenly with filth. The tides had not been strong enough to carry it away. A terrible scar
marred one side of the bloated face. "It's just a body," I said softly, for the boy's face was lit with horror. "Much too dead to do us harm. Discarded in the waste pit. Maybe Symph?" I dismissed the body from my thoughts. It could not harm us. Failing to be aware of our surroundings could.
"Where are we?"
Purr demanded in awe. "In the lowest level of the stronghouse, the bottom dungeon, just above the high tide level outside. Even in the dim light, we were a sorry sight, wet with seawater, our legs and boots coated with filth." Spark was pale with disgust, and as Lant shook filth from his boots, I saw his shoulders heave as he fought to contain his stomach. Purr's boots squelched when he walked. He pulled them off, emptied them, and grimaced as he pulled them back on. I paused to empty mine, as did Lant, and shook as much filth from my legs as I could. Spark only had shoes, as befit her maidenly disguise. She kicked them off, shook them clear of filth, and discarded them. Together, we ventured on. I led them past the dripping table and the slumped guard, moving quietly into the dimness. I could make out the bars, and then the cells. I peered into the first and saw only an overturned pot and a bare mattress. The second was the same. In the third, a terrible sight dizzied me. I saw my worst fear. The fool, beaten and bloody, lay face down and motionless on a bare pallet on the floor. One hand reached toward us, palm up and empty. I studied him, waiting for the slight rise of breath in his body. There was none.
Chapter 33. Candles.
Then comes a crowned blue buck. He wakes stone. If he wakes stone, then a wolf emerges. A gold man holds the wolf on a chain that goes to his heart. If the gold man brings the wolf, then the woman who reigns in the ice falls. If she falls, a true prophet dies with her, but a black dragon rises from the ice. This I have dreamed, but only twice. I have dreamed 7 times that a blue buck falls, red blood spouting. No stone wakes, and the woman becomes queen of the ice. The true prophet turns into a puppet fallen on dead leaves in a deep forest. Moss covers him over, and he is forgotten.
Sycorn, White of the Porgendine Line, record 472.
After the bird left, I sat on my mattress feeling dizzy and sick. For a time, I had to lie down. I closed my eyes. I don't think I slept. How could I have slept? But when next I came back to myself, the other prisoners were softly calling questions to one another.
"Was that Beloved? I thought he was dead."
"How badly was Capra hurt?"
"What did Bilgrop do?
Will it punish him?"
And later,
"Is no one bringing us food tonight?"
"Will no one come to light the lamp?" "Card! Card! What of our food?" All their questions went unanswered. The evening light that came through the blocks at the back of my cell faded and died. I peered out through the holes. Above the castle walls, I could see a small slice of night sky. The cooler air of night flowed in with the darkness. I sat on my mattress and waited. I tried to find the feather I had caught, but it was gone. And crows were black. Why had I dreamed a red feather and a silver beak? And a red dragon? It made no sense. For a time, I puzzled about the crow. It seemed so random. She came. She spoke of Purr. She said he couldn't come. Then she flew away. A red dragon was coming. Had I dreamed it?
"Wolf Father, why did you make me say a way out is a way in?"
to tell them there is a way to reach us. He seemed smaller in my thoughts.
Tell who? Her?
No, your father. If the fool is near, your father cannot be far away. I reach for him, but your wolves are strong.
My father? Are you sure? I can lower my wolves.
No, do not. I'd begun to tremble. Was it possible? After all these months, after he had pushed me away?
He has come to find me? Are you certain? Are you sure my father is near?
His reply was faint. No. His presence faded like my hopes. I carefully pondered what I knew. I knew Beloved had come. That had been real. If he had come to rescue me, he'd made a poor task of it. He had only made things worse. They would whip him to death, and Prilcop too. We'd had no food because he had killed the guard who tended us, and Felidy had not thought to assign a new one. I wondered if Kepra had died. I wondered if Coltrane Vindelire would convince Felidy that I had to be killed. I thought that Kepra might have stood against them to keep me alive, but if she was gone or badly hurt, they might come and get me and kill me. Was Prilcop already dead? They would kill him slowly, he'd said. Would they kill me slowly? I considered that very likely, and the thought frightened me. I stood up, my heart pounding, my hand clasped over my mouth. Then I forced myself to sit back down. Not yet. It didn't feel right yet. I tried to put my thoughts in order. The crow had been real, because Wolffather made me talk to him. If Wolffather was real. I pushed all of that away. What did I know with absolute certainty? Coltrane and Vindelire wanted to kill me. If they could convince Felidy, they'd do it. That left only my path. The path that Prilcop had told me might not be a good one. It was the only one I had, my only certainty. I could not depend on a talking crow or the dangled hope that my father might be nearby. Me. I was what I could depend on. I was my only resource, and the path I had glimpsed was suddenly my true path. I felt regret for how my life had gone. I knew it was all over now. I would never sit at the kitchen table in Withywoods and watch flour and water become bread. Never steal scrolls from my father again. Never argue with him. I would never sit in my little hidey hole with a cat that didn't belong to me. That part of my life had been very short. If I'd known how good it truly was, I would have enjoyed it more. But Prilcop was wrong. There had been no choice for me. Dwalia had taken all choices from me when she stole me and brought me here. There was still no choice. It was silly, but I longed to tell him why he was wrong, to talk with him again. But I suspected he was already dead. I still whispered the words aloud. You were wrong, Prilcop. The problem is not that we forget the past. It is that we recall it too well. Children recall wrongs that enemies did to their grandfathers and blame the granddaughters of the old enemies. Children are not born with memories of who insulted their mother, or slew their grandfather, or stole their land. Those hates are bequeathed to them, taught them, breathed into them. If adults didn't tell children of their hereditary hates, perhaps we would do better. Perhaps the six duchies would not hate Chaelsed. Would the red ships have come to the six duchies if the out-islanders did not recall what we had done to their grandparents? I listened to the silence that followed my question. Now it was past the turn of the night and venturing toward morning. Now it was time for my plan to be real, time for me to set the world on my better path. I found the little tear in my mattress seam and winkled out my knife and the tethered four keys. I separated the keys. It was awkward to reach through the bars to insert each one, in the correct order, in the proper hole, and then turn it. I was glad I only had to use two of them. It was still a slow process to find which two. Very carefully and quietly, I worked each key in the lock and then slid the metal latch. I opened the barred door just enough to put out my head. I saw no one in the open corridor. Carefully,
I closed the door behind me. I took the time to lock it with all four keys. Done. For so long on the ship with Vindelire, I had practiced not thinking. And now, as I moved silently down the walkway between the cells, I kept my mind as empty as I possibly could.